You've had a dynamic where money's become freer than free.
If you talk about a Fed just gone nuts, all the central banks going nuts.
So it's all acting like safe haven.
I believe that in a world where central bankers are tripping over themselves to devalue their currency, Bitcoin wins. In the world of fiat currencies, Bitcoin is the victor.
I mean, that's part of the bull case for Bitcoin.
If you're not paying attention, you probably should be.
Tom, are you having fun yet?
Always. Even when I'm not having fun, I'm having fun. I mean, it's, you know, it's funny, Marty. I get up, I do the thing, and every time somebody asks me how you doing, I'm like, another great day in Trump's new America. Like, you know, that's all I'm saying. Like, and I'm doing that just to remind everybody, like, everybody, relax. Take a pill. Rome doesn't need to be fixed in a day. It's actually, as a matter of fact, it's more fun if it isn't fixed in a day. It's more fun to like string them along and then, you know, slam them. It's actually more fun that way. So. Well,
that's been the most perplexing thing this week. Everybody throwing their arms up in the air over tariffs. Like, oh my God, it's like, he's literally been saying this. He campaigned on this for a year.
I know.
It's like, what?
Oh my God. No, I know it is. It's really funny. I just checked the Dow close. I was actually expecting a bump into the close this afternoon. I'm actually surprised that that we closed down over 2,000 points today. But to be honest with you, it's a good thing. Like I know there's a lot of people losing their ass right now, but like, you know, the margin calls come. They do what they do, and this is what happens if you're overlevered. So, but it has to happen because they need to drive the long end of the yield curve down. And they told everybody that this is what they were going to do, and then they did it. And then the Chinese responded in exactly how you would almost. I mean, it's funny. The Chinese announcement this morning, I think, is what actually sent the market down into the close for the week. But the big question then is, you know, is that even a little bit of kayfabe? Because, or is it really that, you know, Xi is panicking because he's in trouble politically and he's not sure what to do. It's all up in the air right now. And I think that the best thing we can do is not overreact. It's the stock market. The stock market is supposed to do things like this. We're not used to it because we're used to the magic money tree and all the USAID money and all this and all that, just going out there and then liquefying all this. And the reality is that, you know, and again, I know the common refrain is to blame the Fed on this. And I'm not doing my, hey, I'm going to be a Fed apologist thing here. That's not what I'm doing. But as you realize that after you listen to Musk talk and he shows you the, you know, the 14 computers with the magic money button, you realize that admission by Elon, or that reveal by Elon, is that we have a money creation engine, we have a tax collection engine, and we have a budgeting engine, and none of them talk to each other. We would normally think that these are handled like a company would, or somebody would, where it would be, you know, that the money would flow into the same department that then, you know, writes the reports of how it's being spent. And then, you know, and everybody's, it's all one system. No, these are three separate databases completely. And, you know, the numbers that they bandy around on Capitol Hill for the budget, the amount of money that the Treasury is actually spending, and whatever the revenue department is collecting, those three things aren't, they have nothing to do with each other. And so when you have a system like that, there are no checks and balances, which means that they can just keep printing, they can just keep pushing the make more money button in the Treasury department, and then everybody has to react to it. And then, oh, by the way, they blame the Fed on the back end. And I'm like, I wonder why that is.
and you have Jerome Powell. It seems like I'm sure you caught quotes from his interview this morning, or probably watched it in totality, but he it seems like today I was watching it, he feels like he's in a position where it's obvious that that's happening. He's like, it is not my problem. He was asked point blank, like, are you going to lower rates and print money? He's like, I don't feel compelled to. I don't feel like we're in a rush to do that. And somebody from the crowd yelled, really, you're not in a rush? He was like, yeah, we're not in a rush. And I think that's like an implicit acknowledgement of what you just described. Right. Like, there's problems over there that need to be fixed. And I was doing this last night. I think you hopped in the thread momentarily, but you're like, if you zoom out on the 10-year, going back to 75, I believe, and you look at, and I was just doing left side of the bell curve, caveman brain, mm-hmm. sort of TA, and it looks like we're coming into like a secular bear market mm-hmm. in the 10-year again. And with all the efforts of Trump at Bessent since the inauguration, they've done a good job of getting it down materially. It was below 3% for most of the day. I checked right before we hopped on. It was hovering around 4. I'm not mm-hmm. sure if it's below 4 again. But you can imagine a scenario in which Jerome Powell's like, something's going to break here, and I don't want to be the one that basically leads to the implicit default of the dollar system by lowering rates, printing a bunch of money. Like,
it's not going
to
be
the onus is on the fiscal side to figure this out.
Well, he's been saying that for years, and this has been part of my argument as to why I don't think Powell was complicit in whatever there was that was going on during the Biden administration, right? It was clearly that, Yellen at Treasury and Powell at the Fed were not on the same team. Now, as far as where he is right now, and I know that Trump came out and said, Jerome, you got to cut rates now, blah, 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 blah. Cutting rate, and I think Trump may be right ultimately about that, but even a quarter point, I just think, from Powell's perspective, cutting a quarter point here, all that's going to do is restore the upwardly sloping yield curve that he worked so hard to get before Trump took power. And, but there's more going on here than just Jerome Powell and Donald Trump. That's a story that wants to be created. And Trump likes to create stories. We know that the story is far more complicated than that. We know that the story is that there are people out there who shall remain nameless, but their initials are DAVOS, that want to, manipulate our yield curve to sell a narrative. They've been doing it for 4 years. They should, they've been doing it forever. But now they've explicitly been doing it to their benefit, in order to effectively close the circle, in order to close the gate and destroy what's left of the U.S. Fiscal and monetary policy during the last administration, or junta, as the case may be. And why would they stop doing that? Because Trump's in power. As a matter of fact, they would double down on that strategy, right? I mean, it's the only thing that makes any sense to me. So coming into this week, I've been screaming to my patrons and every once in a while when I do a podcast, I'm like, understand that they're selling the recession narrative by selling their stock of 10s and 30s, 10 years and 30 years, and buying ones and twos and creating that dip in the yield curve and really selling the long end and really, playing the dip in the belly of the yield curve to sell that, we're going to have a terrible recession, which, over the next year or two, which again, it's an easy sell, right? It's not like it's a hard narrative to sell, but they're clearly like, no, really, it's going to happen. And I'm like, and they need to do that if they want to affect, they're going to sell the 30, buy dollars, and then sell the dollars to buy twos. And that way they can play games with the euro. They can play games with the pound. They've got massive stock that they have bought over the last 3 years. They've got all this ammunition. So we're going to find out if I'm right about that when the next TIC report comes out for February, right? And we'll see if there's an inkling of that, because what we have seen is that the stock in Europe hasn't really gone up. In Q4, there was really, it was just kind of, the buying had stopped and now we were kind of flatlined. So now, is it going to roll over? Are we going to see them having, you know, dumped a couple hundred billion dollars with the treasuries over the next 3 months? We're going to find that out 3 months in arrears, of course, like we always would through the TIC data. So, and this, that gives you plenty of time, by the way, of course, to sell a narrative. And, but it's not enough time to sell an actual recession. Right? Now you think about it. So I don't know, man. Like, to me, you have to factor that into whatever it is that you think you're seeing. Because there are plenty of people out there who want to sell a particular narrative in order to keep the focus on the United States and ignore everything that's happening over here. Because everything, you know, because again, everything that I watch screams to me that the markets are choosing the United States over Europe. Credit spreads between the U.S. and Germany are narrowing, right? The U.S.-German 10-year spread, I think, is going to close this weekend around 1.4, 1.45%. Same thing, and the two-year spreads much wider than that. It's like 1.8. But again, this is Lagarde like holding on to something that's necessary. Now the 2 and the 10-year spread aren't even, you know, they've been mirroring each other for years. So whatever the 2 is and the 10, if there's any air between them, it usually closes very quickly. So the bond traders have been holding those spreads very tightly and having the German yield curve mirror the American yield curve and a very tight spread across duration for years. And then since the USAID money went away, now all of a sudden what was a tight spread, or if it got out of whack for a couple of weeks or whatever, it would close. If the 2 was significantly lower than the 10, then one would correct towards the other. Now it's been sitting here at 40 basis points for like 2.5 weeks now, and it's the widest I've ever seen it. So clearly there's something going on here. And then we take it one step further, and I finally looked at German-Italian spreads, 10-year. And I noted over this 4-year period, since they affect 3-year periods, since the Fed started raising interest rates, we all started coming off the zero bound. Italian debt has vastly outperformed German debt. Like the spread was over it was like 275 basis points 3 years ago. It's now 100. Now, factor all that in when you start thinking about what you're seeing out of Giorgia Meloni, what you're seeing out of Trump, what you're seeing, you know, clearly I think Powell and Trump, and I think they're driving wedges here. They forced Lagarde into this financial repression scheme, and they're going to blow her up. And I can just see it. I can just smell it. And what we're seeing right now is, well, we need to focus everybody on the, oh my God, the stock market is failing. Like, whatever. Dude, it's like we were at a Shiller PDE of like 38, for Christ's sake. You think
it's the highest since dot-com bubble.
Yeah. No, it's almost as bad as the dot-com bubble. The dot-com bubble, I think, had a high of like 48.
Yeah, something
insane.
It's in the same stratosphere.
Mm-hmm. I mean, honestly, and anything over 20 is obscene.
What's up, freaks? Do you have a credit card? Are you getting cash back or airline points or points for some other service? Guess what? Those are shitcoins. You want to be stacking Bitcoin. And I have some groundbreaking news for you. The team at Fold has finally released the Bitcoin Rewards credit card. They have a wait list. They're going to be distributing the cards later this year. So you want to get on the wait list. Fold Plus members are going to get unlimited 2% Bitcoin back on this credit card. If you get on the wait list, they're up to $200,000 in prizes they're going to be given out. So get on it as quickly as possible. Go to tftc.io/fold and get on the wait list there. If you're on the wait list, you have the potential to win some of the prizes. Check it out. Sup, freaks? This rip of TFTC was brought to you by our good friends at CoinKite. They make the Cold Card Q, my favorite hardware wallet, the most secure hardware wallet on the market. As you can see, it's got the BlackBerry form factor, full keyboard. It's got 2 secure enclaves. You create your private public keys offline. The device never has to go online, never does go online. So you keep your Bitcoin secure. If you have your Bitcoin on exchanges and you're looking to get it off, secure it in the best way possible. Pick up a Cold Card Q. Go to coinkite.com, find the Cold Card Q, use the code TFTC for 5% off. If you're a power user of Bitcoin, like I am, if you're running a business on a Bitcoin standard, if you're just a Bitcoiner who wants to secure your Bitcoin, get the most secure hardware wallet on the market, go get the cold card queue. It's a beautiful thing. When it comes to like another, like something that would signal to me that the Trump admin is highly aware of this and they're playing, if I hate it's an overplayed term, but like 4D chess, if you will, like Trump and Jerome and Bessent, that triumvirate. And I think Trump and Bessent are playing good cop, bad cop, where Trump will come out, it's the Fed, it's the Fed. And then you have Bessent going on like Tucker Carlson today, going on the All In podcast a couple of weeks ago, Lutnick doing it. Like, I think to combat that recession narrative and the potential weaponization of these treasury assets that are held by European entities, they're being hyper communicative with the public about this. And I think they had to choreograph the stock market and everything to basically make people not freak out as much, even though there is a lot of people freaking out, but most of them seem pretty low IQ.
Well, you know, it's funny. Have we all forgotten that Scott Bessent was there when George Soros was playing his games in the 70s and 80s, you know, 80s and the 90s? Like, it's not like he doesn't know what the game plan is. He doesn't know what their strategy is. He doesn't know how they operate. And they really only have one operation. It's the same operation they use over and over again, which is to, you know, which is to destroy commercial banks and then roll the power up into the central bank. And one of the interesting things about, and you just, you know, you play the markets and the bond markets and the currencies in order to make that happen and push markets into meltdown over a policy that you disagree with. They did this to Japan. They did it to the English. They've done it. And they've done it at times with the Americans in the past. And every time there's a big crisis, we see, you know, a whole bunch of banks go under, get consolidated, we get consolidation of the banking industry. We've lost 2/3 of our banks since the late 70s, where we had over 14,000 commercial banks in the United States. Now we're down to under 5,000 or just around 5,000. But there comes a point where you say, okay, well, if they know all this and they're the guys in charge, you think they're just going to like stand by and let them do what they've always done in the past? It doesn't look to me like it doesn't make any sense. I mean, so I would say you're right, certainly, that they've done what they've needed to do to say, look, it's, you know, you shouldn't really worry about the stock market. I think one of the things that Trump retweeted a short video that was running out there this morning about, hey, look, like 94% of the stock market is owned by 8% of the people. That's not what this is about. You know, like and Warren Buffett's already in cash and yada, yada, yada. So like we were going to let the stock market go because it's about, we have to deal with this like massive, you know, tranche of treasuries. We had to deal with this mess that fucking Janet Yellen left us, which I was screaming about the entire time this was going on. You know this, like that she was, you know, issuing ones and twos and not issuing tens and twenties. And like, and now we have to deal with this. And that's all that stuff. And all that stuff was issued at, you know, 4.5 and higher. And now we've got the 10-year under 4. And you can get that, you know, rolled out at under 4%. That's a big deal. And you can't fix this, you know, with waving your hands, putting a couple of people in jail, and, you know, you can't unfuck us in 100 days. It's just not possible. You're going to have to watch the process play itself out. And, you know, the interesting part about what comes next, I think, is, you know, what does he do to say, okay, we're going to stabilize this now? You know, and that's where we're going to start getting into what assets are they going to throw in the sovereign wealth fund? What are they going to do with gold? What are they going to do with all the housing equity? Well, the European Union is out there saying that they're going to mobilize. I love the use of the term mobilize. The excess savings, a phrase that only a communist like Christine Lagarde will love.
What is so egregious?
It means they're going to bail these people in. They're going to hand them like perpetual bonds at zero, at 25 basis points. They're going to steal all their wealth. You know what that's what they're going to do because they already know they're trapped, right? I was actually chatting with Grok about this the other day. I, you know, by the way, I'm now firmly convinced that Grok is going to be our AI, because what other AI in the world is being trained faster than Grok on all the data that's coming, that's flowing through Twitter slash X on a daily basis, right? But I was talking to Grok about this the other day, because I was working on my newsletter for Newsmax, and I was like trying to explain what I think is coming with the EU, which is I think that they're getting ready to rug pull the entire world. Like, I think they're whole, not their, the entire world, but their people. Like, they've already, they've announced all the bits and pieces, and then they're just going to do it. And I said, okay, Grok, I'm going to lay some stuff out for you. I'm going to leave out some stuff that I know you know, but because I've had, because of other conversations that Grok has had with other people that I know about a variety of things. I said, I'm just going to throw these things out at you one by one. Okay, so now we're there's the Savings and Investment Union. Do we have any details on that? Do me a favor. Go do a deep dive. Tell me what we know. We know nothing. We know the name of it, and we know that it's going to mobilize excess savings. We know nothing else about it. Like, Grok couldn't find, like, there are links to PDFs that they say they've published that Grok couldn't find. It even went so far as to check variations on the URL that just because they might have typed it in wrong or whatever, like couldn't find it. So they're hiding what it is, whatever it is that they think they're going to do about this thing. That's one. We had in that the announcement of the digital euro in October, and all the military spending that they want to do, the Rearm Europe project, right? This thing. When you put all that together, it tells you a couple of things, and the fact that the Germans have now blown past their budgetary rules and are going to rearm like it's 1939 or something. And I'm not kidding when I say that, because that's what's going on here. Now the Germans are sending troops permanently stationed to the Lithuanian border, you know, into Lithuania. Like, this, you know, Martin Armstrong's been banging his shoe on the table about this stuff. And he's right. Marty's completely right about this. And you can see all the pieces. I said, Grok, tell me where I'm wrong. Like, do the solve. I think this is what they're going to do. Tell me I'm wrong. What are their options given this situation? Grok was like, well, they could pivot to China and try and do more of their trade that way, because they obviously, the United States is now, they've got a problem, because Grok brought up the euro dollar system and the fact that the euro dollar system is now, he brought it up like that. It's a lot less liquid than it was before. And I'm like, the deuce you say. You're like watching this scroll by and I'm like, huh? Okay. Someone else is, I'm not done. Okay. Grok's not stupid. And I know Grok has, I don't even think Grok's ever read my blog, to be honest with you. So I'm like having this conversation with this thing and I'm like, and it came to the exact same conclusion I did. And I said, okay, well, now take all of these other things into consideration and tell me, you know, what happens when Trump puts tariffs on and then we do this and then we do that. And he's like, they have no other option. They have to do what you're expecting them to do, which is the one, either create a false flag in order to force the United States in. You know, I started talking about the war in Russia and this, that, and everything else. And I brought up collateral, right? The fact that they have no energy collateral. They've been cut off from, they've cut themselves off from basically American energy and Russian energy. We have North African energy is getting taken away from them, thanks to Erdogan. Erdogan staying in power and having moved into Syria has cut them off from trying to get, you know, access to Middle Eastern energy. Right. And become the new overlords of the Middle East. And they failed completely at that because neither the Russians nor the Americans over the last 10 years have allowed them to do this. By the way, again, I'm going to remind everybody, that's why Trump canceled the JCPOA. It was to stop France from making major energy deals with Iran. OK, this was important because then that would give the EU a lifeline out and would allow them to continue to get the collateral they need in order to then continue their integration with the global architecture of the WTO, the WHO, the IMF, all of that, the UN and all of it, because they know, he knows that that was the plan. And it's so, I'm like, and it's so obvious in hindsight that he understood all this then. But he didn't talk about it in these terms. He never did. He just blamed Obama for everything. And he blamed Obama for everything because that's an easy sell. So he knows his audience really well. And I just don't think we ever gave him enough credit for this stuff, including myself. I don't think I gave him enough credit for this back then. So,
yeah. I mean, in Europe, in France, I think maybe across the whole EU, they're saying, go buy a prepper bag where we're going to provide you with one.
Yeah, no, yeah, that's another data point that I think I threw across as well. Like, I had this conversation a week and a half ago, and that's now gone, right? It's like, whatever, stick it in long, stick 20% of it in long-term memory, and then the rest of it gets kind of lost. But yeah, no, you're right. Like, they're telling people, build a prepper bag because they're literally telling you they're going to crash their own economy. They've told you that this is what their plan is. They've said this before, you know, and, you know, they bailed in Greece. They bailed in Cyprus. I mean, they've, in the past, they've already had the legal network set up for this. And as I've been saying over and over and over again, everything that has been laid at the feet of the United States, our fiscal nightmare, our lack of, you know, a lack of discipline and all the rest of it, right? All the stories and that have been built and the I'm now going to just frankly call it gaslighting. The gaslighting of the idea that the United States is broke and is non-functional and should be put into receivership and it's broken up for parts is a British psyop, or better, a Davosian psyop. If you don't like my invocation of the British, go right ahead and call it Davosian. I don't give a fuck. Pick your bad guy of choice. Doesn't matter. It's a psyop. Why? Because as Bessent has been telling us, we have trillions of dollars worth of assets that we cannot bring to the table because of dumb environmental policy or dumb regulation or dumb this or the insane. How about that video of John Stewart being told the permitting requirement to get broadband?
The 14 points.
Right.
It took like 20 minutes to explain.
Right. To explain it to him. And then he's like, oh my God. I'm like, God, dude, now imagine what it's like to try and get a refinery built.
I know people in California, or not even only California, but doing oil and gas exploration. You have to do like environmental surveys on whether or not you will disrupt the habitat of the hornback lizard. It takes time, and you get it done, you pay, you get it done, you send it to the people who are supposed to review it, and take like 6 months for them to get back to you. And right. It's like, all right.
They're too busy jerking off in front of their Zoom calls. Dude, I can't get my county road. The county road that I live off of, and I live on a private easement off a county road, it's just a little dirt road that really needs to have the water drained off of it during rainstorms because it kind of rains a little bit in Florida, right? They're not allowed to move the water. There's nothing but planted pines, but they're not allowed to move the water. They can cut drainage ditches along the side of the road and leave the road high and then have big drainage ditches. Dude, we get 14. We can get like 12 inches of rain in an hour. Like, it's insane. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it doesn't work that way. And it's sugar sand, so it turns into a sloppy mess. And they spend more money bringing a guy down from Lake City to run a grader over our road so that the school bus can get down the road every once in a while. If it wasn't for the school bus, forget it. We'd never get a road graded. But it costs them more money to regrade the road, but they can't move any of the dirt because they can't allow the water to leave because we haven't done an environmental assessment policy. Like, it's insane. Like, it's water, and it needs to go somewhere. And we're just going to let it sit there? Meanwhile, people's cars are flooding out. Their brakes are being destroyed. Their U-joints are wearing out. Like, you know, the hundreds of thousands of dollars it's cost all of us to keep our cars running down our little dirt road is insane. Like, it could, you know, like, unnecessary. But that's just one little, and that's in a low tax county. It's in one of the reddest counties of Florida. But this is Florida rules that were put in place by a shitbag GOP that takes their their marching orders from the national GOP, who were in cahoots with the DNC to destroy America. Like, this is the way this shit works. And honestly, at the end of the day, every person I talk to, and I'm like, I explained this, I said this before, I talk to, and they find out what I do, and they're like, okay, so I don't care about anything else. When can we start shooting them? That's the only answer. That's the only question I ever get asked. And I'm like, that's between you and whatever God it is that you think is judging you in the afterlife, I guess, and the state of Florida. But yeah, I get your frustration. We all drive trucks for a reason. Yeah. We drive trucks, and even then the trucks even their suspensions aren't designed for this stuff. It's terrible.
Yeah. So you're hopeful all that red tape is going to be ripped away.
That's also what's ticking away in the background while we're all focused on tariffs. Like, there's other stuff that's happening, right? I certainly hope so. I know that, Stephen Miller has made the point explicitly, like, we don't have to challenge these rules in court and then have them overturned because Chevron's no longer, all these cases that were adjudicated under Chevron are null and void. They're gone. They don't have to be re-adjudicated. They don't have to be, re-adjudicated and then new judgments. We don't need to retry all these cases. All those judgments have been rendered null and void. We don't have to follow any of these rules anymore. So, but in some ways, I wonder sometimes whether or not Trump understands that that's a bigger battle to fight than the tariff thing. But I don't know. I think what he's constantly doing is he's shifting the venue that he wants to fight in order to keep them off balance. I think that's what he's doing. I don't know whether it's a good strategy or not at this point. I can't quite tell. I'm more than happy to plead the fifth on that one. Like, I don't know if this is all going to be a winning strategy for him. I'd like to believe that it is, but it might actually not work for him if he cannot start putting scalps on the table.
I think objectively, at least in the last month, he's made the mainstream media look utterly stupid. Mm-hmm. And two specific examples stick out to me. One, where everybody was up in arms because that quote unquote innocent guy got sent to El Salvador and wasn't an MS-13. And then it came out, they were saying he wasn't an MS-13. There was like, no, actually, or the other one. No, he's actually in the gang. Like, we need, he was here legally. We needed to send him. He was a gang member. And then number two, at the tariffs, literally within 24 hours, you had people like Ford came out. It was like, all right, we're going to start manufacturing cars back in the US. You have paper mills spinning up in Maine.
Yep.
And it's like
it's not like these guys don't have we have automobile lines that they've shuttered over the last 10-15 years. Like, I'm like, he should, I know that he's like frozen the CAFE rules. He should, but he's got a feckless Congress that won't do anything, because I know these guys don't believe yet that he's got the power, I think, to that he's got the staying power to outlast them. So that he hasn't quite proven yet, in my mind. I think this is the way why Congress is acting the way they're acting. And they still think that they can control him and then just ride him out. That's clearly Davos's plan. And just wait him out. And that's what's going on in Europe. They're clearly acting like, I mean, I've had this on, I've heard this from half a dozen people that they just inside the room. I was talking to Marty Armstrong about this. I was talking to other people, and they all said the same thing. Like, inside the room, they just think they can wait Trump out. And they don't realize what's coming. They're going to get hit over the head. And they're going to wake up one morning and they're not going to have a European Union. And then they're not going to know what to do. These people are not jazz musicians. This is the best metaphor for what we're dealing with. We're dealing with people who are at best, third string violinists in an orchestra that know how to read a chart and follow directions from the conductor. And they have no ability to improvise. They don't actually even understand music theory at all, enough to even begin to think about how they would improvise, And you're dealing with someone with like Trump who can't even speak in a direct sentence because he's playing, he's as he puts it, weaving in and out of various topics in order to paint a picture. And, you know, and he just drives him completely batty. And that's his, and he knows this is his greatest strength against them. He knows that they have no idea how he's going to attack them next. And sometimes I think I can see what's been happening. Like every once in a while, he lets the pressure off of them and lets them talk for a little bit. Have you noticed? Mm-hmm. He does it a little bit because he needs to figure out, okay, so how are they going to attack? Because I'm sure that they've got a flow chart. I'm sure that like and whether Trump has got is part of this or not, but he knows that his staff around him, like guys like Miller and others have, you know, they've worked out their flow chart of, okay, well, if we do this and they do that, then we do this, right? Series of moves. Like if you, okay, you take the three wood space, well, I'm going to take the two reeds and you're going to go, you know, playing a game of Agricola and we're going to do that game. And then that's the way this round is going to work itself out. But every once in a while, you got to see what move they're going to make, right? How are they going to respond? And then, you know, okay, well, they're going to respond like that. I mean, we know what their decision space is because everything's opposite day. In their world, whatever Trump does, they do the opposite, right? But yeah, there's a decision space in there. The definition of opposite is a little fungible. So I don't know, like, and then they wait, and then they go, "Oh, so you're going to do that? You're not going to cop to that? Great, we're going to watch you do X, Y, and Z, and now we're going to go in this, and then we're going to make this decision, and we're going to hit you like this." And Trump's really good at that. That's what Trump's, I think that's where Trump's skill set is the highest, is that he understands that once he's started the process of quote unquote making the deal or negotiating or playing the game, however you want to put it, whatever metaphor you want, he's really good at going, oh, that's the state of the game board, we do this. And he's really good at it. And I gotta give him credit.
Yeah.
As a guy who does the same thing like on a regular basis, it's like that's my entire life, right? Is to do that as well. And so I think that you know, I recognize it.
The new administration is pushing hard for government efficiency, but can Elon Musk and Doge fix the dollar? On April 16th, PhD economist Peter St. Ange explains why Bitcoin is the most important tool for government efficiency and how the principles underlying the global shift towards sound money can help you protect and grow your generational wealth. Register now at unchained.com/RHR. That's unchained.com/RHR.
The order of operations and the speed with which they're executing on this is important. I mean, with the tariffs, I mean, just look where oil is. It's, mm-hmm. it's down at like $60 a barrel, and may not be good for oil producers, but I think for the American citizen and attacking the meme of inflation's high, that's good. It's going to be cheaper to fill up your gas tank.
Yep.
Tariffs, domestic food production is probably going to stay domestic.
Mm-hmm.
It's going to bring down grocery bills. We've already seen eggs, which was the big meme. Egg prices are at all time highs.
Yep. Well, they killed a couple hundred million chickens, and then they said, "Oh, and it's Trump's fault that, you know, we killed a couple hundred million chickens, and now there are no eggs." Like,
yeah. And so I think domestically, like, despite the uproar about the tariffs this week, which I think many people are beginning to come around, like maybe they're not that bad.
Mm-hmm.
Even people who are skeptical of them, I think it's becoming clear that people who became tariff experts overnight are,
of course,
abject fools. And then, again, the communication, I think Bessent particularly, we talked about Europe, everything going on there. That's wrong with the assumption they have a grand plan to do that. Right. And I'm interested to get your thoughts on, I read about this earlier this week, but Bessent obviously over the last year has mentioned, I think there's going to be a grand economic reordering in the next 4 years. I want to be a part of it. I want to be in the room. I'm an economic historian. This mm-hmm. is what I'm best at. And then he was on Tucker Carlson this morning and did two things, particularly called out China, basically said they're in a recession, quasi depression, basically signaling to the US people in the world more broadly, like China, it's not us this week, it's China that's weak. And then mentioning gold and Bitcoin as stores of value.
Mm.
To me, if we were to take his words at the Manhattan Institute event last June to heart, and that he really believes that there's going to be this global grand economic reordering, that these are moves he's making to sort of signal mm-hmm. to China specifically, like, if we're going to do this, we're going to need you at the table. And so, like, I can paint you in a weak position publicly, here, and we can do the tariff game, or we can get to the table and figure out what's going on with this reordering.
Yeah, no, I think you're on it. I do think that we're staring at a global reordering. Like, I don't think that's, I don't even think that's up for debate. The bigger question, I think, is, you know, who's going to be left off the table, right? And I think that this is the thing that scares, I mean, it's clearly, it scares the French to death. And this is why Macron is acting the way he is. He's acting like, you know, he's the king of Europe. He's trying to crown himself king of Europe. And by doing this, like, when we talk about this in terms of global reordering, it's very similar to what I've been like screaming about for years, which is that the old system of creating debt and using debt as a means by which to issue currency to then, you know, value people's labor, it's just another form of colonialism. It's all it is. And like, the more I think about it, the more I realize that I've always been kind of right on this thing going way, way back. I'm just like now thinking about where my head was, say, 10, 15 years ago. It's very clear that this is just about the manipulation of currencies and arbitrage in order to create a durable advantage that doesn't close, and such that capital shifts, the capital moves in one direction and doesn't ever move back the other way. And what Trump and dissent are doing are saying, we're not doing that. And I felt when I first started thinking about Powell, that's what came into my head, right? Which was that, no, Powell's clearly saying dollars are no longer going out and goods are coming in return. That's not a model that makes any sense, because we can't protect our banking industry. I mean, I think Powell was thinking about it like a banker. We can't even protect the banking industry if we do that, right? Because now our banks, you know, and the banks are out of control, or the central banks are out of control. The governments are out of control. So we can't even control our own monetary policy. We can't control the value of our own product. So if we're doing that, and remember, that was put into effect during Trump's first term, right? Which was the beginnings of SOFR during Trump's first term. And now we finally hit the end of the last little bit of LIBOR, right? So we had LIBOR officially ended on, you know, the last contract was written on September 30th, but those were 6-month contracts, synthetic LIBOR. So that ended on March 31st. So now, And the synthetic LIBOR contracts, by the way, you know, they're just like agreements between European banks. Well, they don't have to post any collateral for this stuff. They just post each other's, you know, fake repo, you know, swap contracts or repos and swaps. And like, it's all funny money. There's no collateral behind those trades. So those markets are liquefied, right? Until now, Trump goes out on April 2nd. This is, I think, the timing on this is
the timing is crazy.
Yeah, the timing is kind of perfect, right? Now, they got to go out when they need dollars, they got to post collateral because they got to go to a U.S. bank or to the Federal Reserve to get it. And so now they got to post collateral. Now they got to pull from bank reserves to go. This is one of the things that I talked to Grok about. And actually, what was interesting in that conversation with Grok is that he brought that up. Now, he brought that up because he spoke to my friends over at Dolcino over in Italy about 2 or 3 weeks ago, who we were chatting about this in private, and they had a conversation, you know, like my friend Marco had a conversation with them and with Grok. And so it was in his database, but he immediately saw where I was going with this. I didn't even have to nudge him. He brought it up. He brought up the euro dollar system, the end of synthetic LIBOR, the end of this, and said, oh, no, they have to go in to get bank reserve. They have to use bank reserves now to get dollars. Well, if you think about it, who really has been pumping the Mag 7 up to hell and gone? right? We have all this USAID AID money floating around. We have all this NED money floating around. We have all this CIA dark pool money. We got all this DOD money. We got all this Department of Education money, this, that. I know that they've mapped, oh, the guys who are now installed over at OMB, that they've mapped how much money is flows out. And it's probably close to $2 trillion a year. Okay. And I'm like, I have that in the back of my head. I'm like, well, clearly, the minute they have to go and get dollars for real and they have to post real, what are they going to do? They have to sell their stocks, go get dollars to buy, you know, or they got to post to treasuries. They got to do something. I can also see them wanting to try and create a global margin call on the entire U.S. stock market to cause cascading defaults as well in order, again, I don't think we're facing nuclear war with the Russians. I don't think we're facing Trump invading or allowing Israel or supporting Israel to invade Iran or bomb Iran or anything along those lines. I think that's all bluff and bluster. And the Israel thing is really easy. Erdogan's still in power in Turkey. That's it. That's all you need to know. But the real nuclear war is financial. It's when Europe says blackmails the entire world with a financial nuclear Armageddon, saying, look, we're going to cancel our currency. We're going to bail in all our savers, cancel the currencies, cancel the debt, and make you whole with perpetual bonds. Europe's history is that whenever they get into trouble, they choose war every freaking time. First kinetic, both kinetic and or financial, every freaking time. I got 1,000 years of freaking history with these people. Okay? So they tried really hard to get the two countries with the most physical collateral in the world across all vectors, not just oil. The United States and Russia, we control an unbelievable amount of wealth, real wealth. Maybe you can add in Africa, but like, where would you rather do business? The United States, mm-hmm. Russia, or Africa? Clearly the United States, then Russia, then Africa, in that order. So the people who need the collateral are now going to try and blackmail the world, I think, with financial nuclear Armageddon. And then we see what happens. And Trump's already threatened them, because we had the Mar-a-Lago Accords talking about, hey, why don't we just settle up for the last 80 years worth of NATO and all the other money that you owe us? And we'll just give you 0% 100-year bonds, which are worthless.
Yeah.
He's threatened to do
so.
That
and if Europe does this, is the idea that causing this cascading liquidations fall in the stock market to be so globally cataclysmic they could sort of hide in the rubble and point at Trump and be like, it was his fault?
Yeah, it was his fault because he put tariffs on us.
Yeah.
Why do you think so the next move out of the European Union will be to be inconsolable about this? Right. And say, well, he's putting tariffs on us that are higher than only put 20% on them, for Christ's sake. When these people hide behind regulations, one of the things Martin Armstrong brought up in a blog post he did this morning, actually, it was really good. I just happened to read Marty's blog this morning. I don't read it on a regular basis, but, I every couple of weeks I come in to catch up and read a bunch of stuff. And one of the things he said was that France and the EU in general, they don't actually, their tariff rate is, their official tariff rate is a lot lower than their effective tariff rate. And because, they deny our imports because of quality reasons or this or that or anything else. Remember going back to all the Brexit talks and how the Brits were like losing their minds over chlorinated chicken. Do you remember that shit? Mm-hmm. Okay, it was all nonsense. The Americans corny, we like to kill the bugs that are living on the chicken that takes a couple of days to process, and maybe we could. It's insane. Like the amount of unbelievable. So you like, so I get it. You think our food quality is shit and you're not, I'm not going to like argue with it, but not on freaking chicken, guys. Like it was just so dumb. It was clearly a phrase created in an intelligence, you know, think tank to like, what will trigger people the most? Chlorinated chicken. It's like bullshit. Like people, like we don't use disinfectants, and you don't use disinfectants in your, in your meat processing facilities. I don't want to eat the fucking meat you people produce. Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it's insane. But whatever. Like, but that's what they did, and they did this in order to try and scare the Brits into not leaving the EU because, you know, French meat, because French chicken is so much higher quality than American chicken. It's bullshit. It's nonsense. Chicken, it's freaking chicken, for Christ's sake. Get over yourself. It doesn't have any flavor. Like, I don't, you know, whatever. Like, it's, but that's what they, that's what these people do. And it's all gaslighting. And it's part of the trade imbalance. So going back to what I was saying earlier, just to make sure that I like square the circle on what I was talking about. Why Trump put the tariffs on the way he did. And is as follows. What he was saying is, what he's basically said is this. If we had a free market for trade, right, with all our major trading partners, we wouldn't be running regular, durable, year over year, ever widening trade deficits. Because, you know, the currencies would attenuate, and then the money would flow back and forth and blah, 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 blah. And the free market would grind out that arbitrage. A trade surplus, like with Canada, is $124 billion a year. That's a durable advantage created by a mix of tariffs, regulations, blah, blah, all of these things. And so when you see a trade imbalance, like in any time you see, you know, any kind of arbitrage that doesn't close, it's because something's getting in the way. So, for example, go back to, you know, let's look at like when we were all talking about a year and a half ago or so between the price of gold in Chicago and London versus Shanghai. And then for a while, there was this big $40 arbitrage that was going on, and it was holding up for like weeks at a time. Right. Now, normally in the gold market, like you get a short-term arbitrage play like that, like there's a big spike in demand for gold in China. Well, then the traders in London and Chicago turn around, they buy a bunch, and then they ship it. They buy a bunch of futures contracts and then use those and post those as collateral in order to, you know, trade on the Shanghai contract and then close the arbitrage. Right. That's what they'll do over there. And the arbitrage will close and it doesn't take very long. And, you know, the gold bugs will go crazy for 48 hours on Twitter because, oh, my God, something happened. And, you know, what they're trying to do, what they're really trying to do is, yeah, something happened. I need to sell newsletters this month. when the reality is that it's a market functioning normally. There was a spike in demand. Traders came in and alleviated the supply shock, dealt with the problem and moved it around. Now, when that arbitrage didn't close, that meant something. And that's when Vince Lanchi and I spent, you know, weeks talking about this stuff, like what that was. And our mutual friend Eric Jung talked about this as well, which is that what was happening is that the physical gold couldn't be sourced out of the West. Something was blocking the physical gold being moving from London and or Chicago to Shanghai. And that's why the arbitrage stayed in place for weeks on end. Well, I got news for you. That's the metaphor for these durable trade surpluses. Places like, and I'm not talking about a place like, you know, I don't know, the Congo or whatever, that's, you know, that sells a bunch of people cobalt and that's all they have. They're always going to run a trade surplus with us because we don't have anything to offer them. Our high-end goods, that's fine. That's not a big deal. But our trade deficit with Vietnam, that's Chinese dumping of textiles into Vietnam and into the United States to avoid the tariff. You know, French wines, same thing. Like over and over. German cars, same thing. Over and over and over again. Canadian oil, Canadian eggs, fucking maple syrup. That's what this is about. That's what they're... And so there's an entire regulatory schema that's making sure that the money flows in one direction. And while it may have 100 reasons, and the well, actually, folks on Reddit will, you know, well, actually, it's about this. And you may be right, you fucking pedantic asses. But until we can figure out what those things actually are on a case by case basis and work those things out, we have a crisis. This crisis needs to be dealt with. And we're slapping a freaking tariff on them that is going to get rid of half of that arbitrage. That's what Trump did. And by doing that, what he's now doing is saying, okay, what we're going to do now is we're going to claw back that trade surplus. And because we still have the most powerful consumer market in the world, you're going to eat it because you have nowhere else to send your products.
That,
as to your point, Marty, because China is in a recession.
Yeah. And that's like, I had people text me this week, like, this is not good. Tariffs aren't good. Mm-hmm. Like, and that was my exact point. It's like, they need the U.S. consumer, China specifically. It's like they
need,
they're not going to sustain their economy locally or in Southeast Asia, and Russia's probably not.
They need it. Like, they need air to breathe. They need it. Like, women need sex when they're fertile. Like, this is the way it is. Like, this is reality, folks. This is not the model that's in your head. This is not the textbook that you read. This is not your Murray Rothbard pamphlet. What, you know, at the end of the day, this is the real world. And I remind everybody that Magritte and others have, you know, Magritte's very famous for this, you know, his painting of a pipe with the statement, this is not a pipe. It's a picture of a pipe. It's a model. It's not the world. Go, you know, if you're not sure what I'm talking about, go look up Ian McGilchrist, go listen to him, go listen to that brilliant Scottish man talk for an hour and a half about the difference between models that your left brain builds and the world you actually interact with. This is the world we interact in, okay? There is theory, and then there's realpolitik. And realpolitik is a fundamentally different world. And we can be guided by principle that we want free markets and we want capital to flow across borders, and we want people to act peaceably towards each other and everything else. And that's a fine and lovely and wonderful idea. And then there's the people you're actually dealing with. And so we're dealing with evil friggin' pedophilic vampires of old Europe. And how are we going to get rid? And how are we going to bankrupt them so that we can get closer to your ideal? Or are you just going to are we just going to all be left libertarians from the 70s and screen the open borders? Like, no, like not with a welfare state, not with a warfare state. Hell, even Rothbard said that was incompatible with libertarianism. 40 years ago, he said, you know, before he died, like, this is, it's all dumb. Like, at the end of the day, remember, Murray, like, enthusiastically backed Pat Buchanan, of all people, who was in no way, manner, shape, or form a free marketeer in terms of economic policy. Just to remind everybody. Yeah. You know, in case everybody's history is a little light because, you know, your head is only full of the shit that whatever, you know, MI6 put into it last week through the DNC and Emily's list. Like, you know, get over yourself.
Yeah. Do you think a critical mass of American citizens are picking this up?
Yes. Go look at the numbers on your favorability ratings of Europe. They're awful for Republicans and independents. It's awful. Trump's winning. He's winning the messaging war on this because he beat them because he's attacked them across multiple vectors. Again, not linear thinking. What's he doing? Oh, they still want war. Oh, they want us to pay for NATO. And they want us to go to war. Oh, and they're cheating on trade. Oh, and they're doing this. Oh, and they're doing that. And their response to everything we do is to hector us and treat us like mouth-breathing Americans. Oh, really? Like, you're so cultured? All you people ever do is go to fucking war and then ask us to bail you out after you're done doing it. After you get yourself into trouble because you can't field the freaking Navy. You can't field an army. Really? Like, if you don't think like those training videos that come out of, you know, the British or the German training videos, if you don't think that those aren't coming from people connected with Trump, that they're not playing the fifth generation warfare stuff, like, you're nuts. Of course they are. But then again, it doesn't even have to come directly from the Trump people. It can just be, we have the trolls on 4chan. They know what to do.
Yeah. Oh, they know what to do better than anybody. Mm-hmm. And you have to imagine domestically, the EU is just losing out because of the immigration crisis and the hate speech laws. Yeah. At least in UK, Ireland, it seems like things are really hitting ahead in those regards.
Well, I mean, I think what they're doing is they're just doubling down into the end. I think we don't know what else to do. Flood it. This is like when it was clear that they took their shot at Trump and missed. Everything we've figured out, we've been able to piece together since then, is they just start spending money left and right. They spent every dollar that they could. They shoved as many dollars through the magic money machines as they could on their way out the door, right? I think they're doing, and they opened up the floodgates at the border, and they did this, and they did all of it. And they're doing, and they accelerated everything. It was like, it's like that moment in V for Vendetta when John Hurt screams about, we have to do a full on assault to remind the people how much they need us. It's the same thing. We have to create as much fear and as much anxiety, and we have to try and push our agenda as close to, as close to the finishing line. We got to push it over the finish line. And they only know one way of doing that. And that's fear.
Yeah.
And warmongering.
Yeah, that's why I think the combination of the speed of the blitzkrieg by the Trump administration, the overcommunication, mm-hmm. like their media strategy has been incredible. Mm-hmm. In the first 2 months, like getting on All In, getting on Tucker, Stephen Miller out there explaining everything when something pops up. It's really impressive, honestly.
Yeah. They and came that, in, they were prepared. That's what,
yeah. And we've had Mel Madison and others on, and I think that's the consensus. It's funny. The consensus contrarian view, the contrarian view in the mainstream is the consensus view in our circle, which is that, or I don't know if you believe this, but like the whole strategy was come quick out of the gate, get yields down, let the stock market crash, get it to a point, roll over some of the debt. And then when things have settled at a somewhat stable lower base, then we unleash the economy and you have a rather quick recovery on the back end of all this perceived chaos.
Well, if you
lead you into midterms.
Well, this is where my libertarian brethren should understand it. What is Trump doing? He's trying to liquidate the malinvestment. Like, we're actually watching Warren Harding in 1920. They called him Do Nothing Harding, and they killed him, by the way. I'm firmly convinced they killed Harding. Because Harding refused to do nothing during the Depression of 1920. Well, libertarians use it all the time, this example all the time. Tom Woods and pick your, this is their go-to, right? Mises Institute guys. Hey, look, Harding did nothing, allowed the economy to crash, and then the economy came right back, roaring right back 18 months later after everybody was forced to deal with their problems and liquidate all their malinvestment, get it over and done with. The pain was terrible for 18 months, and then we were right back to where we were in no time flat. Now, on top of that, of course, we started having a sovereign debt crisis in Europe. We had the German hyperinflation, which helped that process out. That's another dimension to their argument that, could factor that in? No, because they're only thinking, as always, they're only thinking about domestic policy, and they're not looking at the entire world as the capital flows across borders, right? But still, it's still a powerful enough argument. Well, it's the same kind of thing. What you just described, I think, is a similar strategy on their part. And I don't even know that, look, the stock market going from the Dow going from 42 to 38 is not a crash. That's a correction. Right. Okay. It's 9%, folks. Okay. It's 9%. All right. Fine. We were at a high of 45. Fine. But when this started to roll over, we were really at what, 43? So it's $5,000 on four. Okay, so it's 12%. Okay, you want to argue with me it's 12, whether it's 15 or 12, it doesn't matter. It's not enough to matter. Do you remember what happened? Like, we had a lost generation where the Dow didn't make a new high from 1966 to 1980. You know, I mean, do we not remember what, how poorly the S&P 500 performed versus everything after, you know, after the dot-com bust? Why do you think, I mean, what, you know, whenever I, whenever people ask me about, you know, some of the, what, you know, what asset classes do you like outside of gold or this and that, like, I always say timberland. You know why? Because trees grow 8% a year. That's why. They got really low carry costs. And in the long run, they outperform the S&P 500. But they don't always outperform the S&P 500. Why? Because the S&P 500 does this. And timberland does this. Like, trees grow 8% a year and you don't need to harvest them when prices are down and there's a recession on. Guess what? Then the trees become more valuable. Why? Well, because now I can get 2x12s. I can get more 2x12s out of that tree as opposed to just getting 2x6s or having to grind the goddamn things down and turn them into pulp or, you know, oriented strand board or whatever. Like, you know, all of a sudden I can get real lumber out of them. Like, and then the stumpage prices go up and then, and they have control over what goes to the market because they're the ones, it's their stuff. Now, it's a fascinating study, but it's going to be interesting when I sit down to like update my model on that after we have a nice sharp correction in the stock market for the next, and maybe we have an 18 month correction in the stock market. It would be good. Nice reorganization of capital. Where does the money need to go? Should it be in tech stocks? Should we be dealing with this AI bubble? Or do we need to be putting money into friggin', you know, transportation, commodities, blah, 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 blah. We have so much. We are so behind the curve on exploration and production upstream across the entire commodity space, which has been capital starved during this ridiculous financialization of our economy. How can you not bet on that? Right. And even when oil prices were refusing to like break back above 80, all the oil majors trading at PDEs of like 4 or 5 or 6, not 15, 18, 28, 37, whatever, and paying 5 to 7% dividends. And they were doing so at $78 a barrel oil. But they didn't have a lot of money to put into finding new reserves. And I have like arguments with people about peak oil all the time. And I'm like, yeah, well, when you have governments that are incredibly hostile to new exploration in places where we know there are trillions of barrels of oil, why are we shocked that the production numbers out of the top 15? I was arguing with Chris Martinson on Twitter about this the other day. I'm like, I just don't buy it. Like, I'm sorry. Like, the inflation adjusted price for oil is now lower than it was in the 1970s using the CPI, which we know is understated. So oil is actually cheaper today. In the 60s, it's insane.
Yeah.
It's truly insane.
Which makes, again, the backlash from, and the backlash is coming from the Reddit class, the managerial class, mm-hmm. a bunch of people who would like to fancy themselves as individuals who can see something and respond to it and know the exact answer immediately. It's like, this is the setup for one of the greatest opportunities to build things in America has ever existed.
And not just for America, but for the entire world. Because if America overthrows its managerial class, it overthrows that, the managerial revolution, which we've already gone through. It's going to have downstream effects for everyone because it's going to outcompete the managerial class everywhere else. At some point, everything becomes too complex, right? Everything becomes too bound up in its own inertia. And sometimes you just have to, like, you know what? Nope, sorry. and we're going to blow through it. But we've told you, you're not allowed to do that. You have to play by WTO rules. We're not, we just took ourselves out of the WTO. You can't do that.
Yeah. I think.
Yes, I can.
Push back a little bit.
It's not
complexity that's the problem. It's complicated. They complicate everything. Mm. Complexity and complication are.
Okay.
I'm a semantic asshole on this one. It's like complex systems are good. They're emergent. Complicated systems are forced on people. They just complicate everything.
No, I stand corrected. I don't see, and you know I don't do that very often, Marty. You are correct. You are completely correct. You are right. But I mean, complexity has its own. It's not just complexity. And then you're correct. I'm just like vamping here now and thinking like when I use the word complex, I mean that we have interconnected things that require a tremendous web of inputs, and you know that's the modern miracle of the entire thing that we do, right? As what we call the economy. You know, it's like all these amazing friggin' decisions that people make in order to try and figure out how to turn what is into what will be. It's a brilliant, beautiful thing. And, you know, emergent, dynamic, chaotic, lovely, all that stuff's great because you never know what's going to come out the other side, right? And you shouldn't, but the control freaks want, they don't want that. What they want is they need control. So yes, they needlessly complicate your life with unnecessary things. And so the one I always go to is the modern diesel engine. Look at what they've done to the diesel engine. It's the simplest thing in the world. It should be, and in order to make it uncompetitive, what did they do? They turned it into a Rube Goldberg device with all of this emission reburning and this and that and everything. And they knew exactly what they were doing. What were they doing? They were trying to kill the fuel efficiency of the diesel engine in order to make it too expensive to produce. Then there would be no comparative advantage than they did to buying one. And then at the same time, they let all the diesel refineries go away, and they wouldn't let us build new ones, so that we restrict the supply of diesel. Then we changed the sulfur rules. Then we did this. Then we did that. Then we put CAFE on. Then by the time we were done, like, yeah, but we didn't outlaw commercial diesel engines and cars and pickup trucks. We just made it such that nobody wants to build one.
Yeah. That was the funniest tweet I've seen in the last month is, whoever invented whoever introduced the concept of your engine shutting off when you hit a red light and then turning back on needs to be sent to El Salvador. Because it's like,
it's so stupid. It's so stupid.
It's terrible for the car. Like I have a BMW. Sorry, not buying American yet, but I have to hit that button whenever I get in the car to make sure it doesn't do it.
Multiple Stellantis products that did this. Like multiple Jeeps or Rams that this, you know, they were, yeah, no, and they're all awful. And every time you get in the car, I turn the car, I push button start, turn the thing on, turn the auto start thing, start stop thing on and off immediately. It was like bing, bing, it's two buttons to start the car every time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, it's the cylinder deactivation. Don't even get me started on that. Like the Dodge Hemi V8 is one of the great engines of all time, but now you destroy it with that. With doing cylinder deactivation in order to get, you know, in order to get to 28 miles to the gallon on the open road. Well, that's great. You can do that. And now this engine that should have lasted 400,000 miles is going to last 100.5.
Yeah. Complicating things, you know. And I think the timing of it is sometimes God works. Universe, God, whatever you believe in, right, works in incredible ways. The timing of this, like thinking about like resetting the economy with all this technology, particularly AI. I mean, you were mentioning Grok, like I've been using it a lot. It is, who knows, there's debates in the tech sphere about how powerful it is, whether or not AGI will materialize. But I think it's objectively true that it is pretty powerful, mm-hmm, to the extent that it can make you much more efficient. And
yes,
being in the venture space, I've seen a lot of companies started by young, excited people that are, really, Gen Z has been radicalized, which is going to work in our favor because, mm-hmm, they have gotten the shit end of the stick. A lot of them were told that they're bad for just being who they are in the first place. They've gotten dejected by colleges for not having the right essay or the right skin color, whatever it may be. And they're motivated to really bring back that American ingenuity and like prove to the world that they are worth it and they can do things. And so you're seeing this, funnily enough, mostly in AI defense tech. Like I'm not sure if you've been following some of the defense tech companies. Like
I haven't.
Anti-war guy, but some of the stuff coming out of El Segundo, California, which the tech they're building can be repurposed for not dropping bombs, but doing productive things is crazy impressive. Like we're talking building 3D printed planes on a $5 million budget that is going to completely change the world. We're transitioning. And I guess that like the last topic, like how could this get fucked up? And what should people be cognizant of and aware of, and particularly from the narrative perspective? Because
I think what I would watch very carefully is how I brought it up earlier. Our biggest tail risk at this point is somebody trying, who desperately needs a war and in order to break down what's left of. We have complex systems. Complexity is not a problem, but complexity is easily attacked. It's also, if it's redundant, like TCP/IP is redundant, right? It sees outages as it sees them as bugs, and it just immediately reroutes the data, right? That's the way TCP/IP was written is a great metaphor. I use it all the time. It's a great metaphor for how systems are really good at adapting to problems, right? But at some point, complex systems can be fragile, especially if somebody is trying to vandalize them. And they would say, well, we knock that one out. Okay, well, that's one thing. Well, we knock that one out too, and that one and that one. Now what? I just took a 2-day trip to New York to celebrate the Newsmax IPO. And I got on 4 flights. All of them were delayed. Every one of them. We were 75 minutes late getting out of Gainesville. Oh, no, sorry. My connection was not. Yeah, and then my connection was late. They rerouted me to a different connection, and we were still late getting off the runway. Silly little maintenance issues, or just it was insane. We were late leaving Charlotte last night to get into Gainesville. Like, Gainesville, it's a nothing airport. We get there. And we have to sit on the tarmac for 10 minutes. Why? Because we were late getting there. Another plane came in front of us, and there was only one ground crew. And they were unloading the other plane, and we had to wait for them to unload that plane before they let us off the plane. Like, and I was just over and over and over and over again. And I was like, and I know that that's part of the plan. The plan is to destroy, it's not just transportation, food web, all of it. And I know people are cognizant of this. And so what I think people should be most worried about is the attrition that we've seen in a lot of these basic industries since COVID. We're still seeing aftershocks of this. And now we're not training the people to replace them. Where we have a shortage of pilots. We have a shortage of like everything competent throughout the entire airline industry. And now we're putting people in the air still. And all the flights were oversold and the prices are, I'm sorry, but the prices are insane. I flew coach, which clearly tells you that you board the plane last. And if you board the plane last, you might not be able to keep your carry-on. You might have to check the damn thing. But if you want your carry-on, and you want to make sure that it gets to your destination because, well, then you can pay us an extra $200 for your ticket. Really? Okay. Yeah. The whole thing is awful. And they're trying to turn every interaction you have with the outside world into going to the Social Security office. Right? That's what they're trying to do. And knowing full well that complexity or that those complications will lead to a breakdown in complexity because you've now taken systems that are, that should be durable and turned them fragile.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I worry about more than anything else at this point. And that's why I've been, you know, screaming for years. Like, what should you do? I don't know, but go and look at your local town and figure out what we're not producing and start producing it. Or make sure that if we are producing something locally, I don't know, food, this, hay, I default to my days as a goat farmer and say, okay, well, I make sure that you deal with your local feed lot and you deal with for your animal feed and you deal with, you make sure that your local hay farmer, can get his product to market. And then, you can contract with him to get 50 bales or whatever the hell you need, like whatever it needs, but then again, it's also the barbed wire guy. It's also the baling wire guy. Like we need him too. We need, we can't allow the pipe factory down the road that makes, all the PVC for North Florida. We have to make sure that thing keeps functioning. Like, you know what I mean? Like, this is the kind of thing like that none of us think about on a daily basis, but there are unbelievable opportunities all the way around. Like,
yeah.
And
this was did you see the debate pop off yesterday or the day before about somebody talking about reshoring manufacturing and talking about, I think, a toaster factory that was spinning back up. People are like, do we need to build the toasters here? It's like, yes. Well, actually, you need to train people to work in a factory setting so that you can then poach them and move them up to SpaceX or Tesla, whatever it is, to build more complex systems.
Right. Like, yeah, I remember that meme was running around. Like, do we really need to be building toasters in 2020 in 2025 in America? I'm like, yeah, actually, we do. Like, unless you believe that we shouldn't be eating bread, that's a different conversation. But yes, we should. And we can make toasters that were as good as the ones that we made in the 1950s, but with better, with better wiring, as opposed to the cheap shit that we make today that are all designed to be worn out in 18 months. Like we now, they're trying to turn the entire world into everything is a service. And again, I go back to it all the time. Like every day, the world is turning into friggin' Philip K. Dick land. Like everything is a service. Everything's a tip. Everything's a, are you kidding me? Like, because somebody decided that they can figure out a way to cut a 3% vig on a toll booth to do nothing. And again, that trade arbitrage I was talking about earlier, I want you people to understand, or you people, I shouldn't have used that phrase. I want everybody to understand that arbitrage I was talking about, that trade, durable trade surplus, that is what economists call rent. It's unearned profit. And that's what Trump is calling back now. And then we can negotiate about the rest of it.
Yeah.
But we're not going to get there until we start bringing that money in. Because if he brings in, say he brings in the $500 to $700 billion in tariffs, that's money we don't have to raise taxes for. That's taxes that takes care of, and we like it. You're not going to fix the budget overnight. You're not going to fix the finances of the country overnight. But I've been screaming from the beginning. I'm like, the world wants the United States to stop doing what it's been doing. Other than our enemies. But our enemies are in no position to replace us. Europe's not in any position to replace us. China's not really in any position to replace us. If, if those reports are true. Or you can start getting into whether or not there's actually, 7.1 billion people in the world or not. I'm the more I think about it, the it doesn't make any sense that there's as many people as they say there is. And what if that's a psyop?
Yeah, I've always wondered that too. Yeah. How do we know it's 8 billion?
We don't know. It's a number that we pull out of our ass, right?
And when you think about it, like again, coming out fast, resetting the market. And then pertinent to me and my life and my beat. Like I think also just being accommodative to the Bitcoin economy here, mm-hmm. where it's like, we're going to do all this. You guys can play with your Bitcoins, have fun playing with your Bitcoins, but like slowly but surely more and more Americans are going to wake up and they're going to have a better long-term savings vehicle through mm-hmm. which they can then reinvest mm-hmm. and do all this stuff as well. And the industry, I'm seeing it. It's happening rapidly. Like the products that are coming to markets really help people get into Bitcoin in ways in which that is sort of like snuck into their life. It's not really in your face. You're not thinking about the daily price movements mm-hmm. are coming to market quickly.
And yeah, no, I think it's incredibly important because look, I'll be honest with you. We waste a lot of energy that we produce. Bitcoin, in my mind, aside from all of its other attributes, I've said this before and I'll remind everybody, Bitcoin's strongest attribute is that it tokenizes waste energy production. And it does so, and it goes out and finds inefficiencies within the energy production market and destroys them. And that's a really, really powerful tool. And then the fact that we can do that and turn it into a token that has, we know there's been work that's been done. We know there was opportunity cost, you know, dealt with by a human to create this unit of thing. New monetary units should always come with an opportunity cost. Like by definition, that's what makes them commodities. There should be a choice to produce that as opposed to this. And because then you have a human making a decision and making a value judgment on their actions. And that's where value is created, right? Inherent in the idea, I value judgment. I value that is more productive use of my time than doing that, right? New monetary units where I push a button and nothing happens, and I can instantiate a dollar or $1 billion. That's where the corruption comes from. That's where everything is. Everything goes wrong. So, Bitcoin's ability, through its architecture, to incentivize efficiency within the energy use space is its greatest attribute because it's literally turning productive work into a token that can be traded that other humans can then value in order to get work done that they need to get done. We've done it with gold. We can do it with Bitcoin. We can do it with both simultaneously, consecutively, and concurrently. I don't care. I don't care. I know that that's what we need. And that's when humans are at their absolute best, I think is what I'm really getting at here.
Yeah. And you'll be happy to hear. I think you know this, but I started help start one of the first team members on a Bitcoin mining company. We did flare gas mitigation in the Bakken. Mm-hmm. Started back in 2018. Company got acquired in 2022, I believe. But back then in 2018, we were on well pads in the Bakken. Mm-hmm. I wasn't physically there, but a lot of our team was. But right. That was once you learned about the supply chain from upstream down to midstream to the market, ultimately, it was always in our mind, like, it doesn't make sense to go and stop the flare on the well pad because it's just logistically and not scalable and inefficient. Right. And the idea was, like, if we go to the midstream, mm-hmm. and instead of consuming the flare on the well pad, suck it in from the midstream because you can actually get scale there and you don't mm-hmm. have to plop up and move all the time. That is the holy grail. And I had a call earlier this morning where ONG companies have honed in on that. And they're like, oh, I get it now. Like, this is what we're going to do. So you just use Bitcoin mining as a pressure release valve if your pipes are getting too full. And it's like, all right, just cycle it to mm-hmm. the Bitcoin miner, and then you have optionality on top of that. Like, what's natty gas trading at? And it's only $2 an MCF. You know what? If I turn this gas towards this generator, produce electricity, mine Bitcoin with it, I'm going to make $5 an MCF. So I'm going to bolster that revenue stream with some Bitcoin mining. Mm-hmm. And then, oh, look, we're pretty well capitalized. We got good cash flow. Let's go drill some more wells. Let's go build some more pipelines.
Right. And the system is self-correcting. And ultimately the system is self-correcting. And, you know, And the other thing that's also interesting about that is then you also have compute power that can be used in other ways. If the Bitcoin mining isn't necessary, if you know, if the compute power isn't needed, No.
It uses the Hashcash SHA-256 algorithm, the ASICs.
I know that it's mostly ASICs, but I'm saying, you know, if the company wants to, they can co-locate.
Yes. They can use the energy
power. You can't use the same compute power in Bitcoin mining because
you can use the electrical infrastructure,
right? Exactly. To run
GPUs,
right? Yeah, to fire the GPUs and do AI and do AI compute, right there. But I mean, just as one example, there's multiple ways of skinning that cat. So, but first you build the base business and then, you know, let them figure out what works and what doesn't work after that. But, you know, this is such an important idea and it's where we're going to wind up. And I'm so happy that, honestly, that Bessent gets this. Like Trump pays back political favors, right? Mm-hmm. That's what he does, right? Maybe he gets it. Maybe, you know, the tech bros around him have explained it to them to the point that he gets it. Maybe. I don't even care. What I care about is that the Treasury Secretary understands this. That's different. That's important.
Yeah. I mean, it was unprovoked. With Tucker, brought up Bitcoin. Bitcoin's turning into a store of value.
Yep.
Set it right alongside gold.
They're going to roll out a lot of different ideas, and they're going to do it. And they've got, and as you've mentioned, their media strategy has been excellent, and they're going to use that media strategy. They're using that media savvy to interject the next thing into the marketplace. Bessent saying that is a direct attack upon the European Union.
And compare that to the EU's narrative. Like, all they have is von der Leyen, Macron, and Christine Lagarde that come out and they just give like a very vanilla, typical politician speech. It's like nobody's picking this up anymore. Like,
yeah, well, I mean, the thing about, but they're all uniquely hostile to Bitcoin. I mean,
oh, yeah.
They're incredibly hostile to it. And anytime they say, and if they ever say anything nice about it, no one's going to believe them. Because we all know what their plans are.
Did I tell you? Did you know this?
I don't know.
The ECB cited one of my newsletters in a paper they wrote disparaging Bitcoin.
Really? Yeah.
It was a nice little medal on the
was lapel it there. Positive or negative?
Negative. They're saying I misunderstood. They were basically taking something I wrote in a newsletter. I think it was about Japan and why. I think it may have had to do with the carry trade blow up and like why this is why you pulled Bitcoin instead of treasuries. And they're like, well, actually,
yeah,
ECB research paper.
Yeah. Now I'm not surprised at all. Actually, that's very cool. Yes. To have anytime you have someone like that, like come after you, it's great.
It's really good. It was a great morning. I had people, I didn't even know that it happened. People are like, Marty, you were cited in the ECB paper. And I actually DM'd one of the co-authors. I was like, hey, would you like to come on the show to discuss it? He was like, yeah, I would. Let me talk to my handlers. Then he came back 6 hours later. It was like, they don't want me to do press like this. And I was like,
oh. Well, I don't actually want to defend anything that I wrote in public. I'm not allowed to do that. I operate, you know, in a very tightly controlled political space. Like obviously. So cool.
Yeah.
It's all good, man.
Yeah. Well, thank you again. I know it's been a long week for you. It's always incredible catching up with you. And I feel like we do it like Friday afternoon every time now. It's a good way to end the week. It's not a
bad time to do it, actually. Like after the market closes, all the drama's over. Thankfully, as of right now, we're not like going to sit down and talk about which banks went under yet. I'm expecting most of them to be in Europe. On the way out the door, just to remind everybody, I think I'm absolutely right about what's going on let's watch the Fed very carefully. European banks start to go under and the swap because they're like screaming that they're worried about swap lines and the Fed and this dollar liquidity. You watch to see who gets the bailouts and who doesn't.
Well, did you see that headline from Germany about the conservative German politicians wondering if we should, if they should call the golden kind from New York.
You know, I saw that. And my response to him, I think on Twitter, was that's nice. We've got 80 years worth of NATO that you owe us back. We pay us for, and possessions 9/10 of the law. So we'll call you.
Exciting times.
Yes, very
incredible opportunity out there. If you're listening to this, if you listen to this and don't recognize that there's a credible opportunity out there, go back, start over, and listen to it as many times as you need to.
As necessary. They hate to plug our own work, but you know. All right, man. You have a great weekend. Thank you for the invite and for catching up and all you do and all the rest of it. I really appreciate it.
You too, Tom. Peace and love, freaks.
Yep. Okay.